For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So tonight for our Sangha talk, we're fortunate to have our work leader, Don Gisler, present something to us. And I wanted to announce, we'll have other announcements later, formally, that starting in August, finally, after much discussion, Don will be leading meditation and recovery meetings the first and third Sunday evening, starting in August, 7:15. So we've been looking forward to that, and thank you very much for taking that on, Don.
Thank you.
And thank you for speaking tonight.
Thank you. Is that me then? Am I on? All right. Good evening. So you're lucky to hear my first public speaking ever. And I wanted to start with a little bit of history. I do want to talk about the fifth precept, which is disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate this body or mind of self or others, body and mind of self or others. But I like I said, I want to give a little history first. When I was younger, I was never, I never went to traditional churches. My parents did not go to church. They were kind of recovering from their childhood church experiences, and they wanted my brother and I to come up with our own beliefs, our own systems. I went to, with friends and relatives to churches, and I always had a good time. It was always fun when I was younger. There was just a lot of fun stuff to do. They make it fun for kids. As I got older, though, I found myself being very frustrated with what was being said. I didn't care for it. It didn't fit. I didn't agree with what was being said. I didn't like that there was this heaven if you were good, hell if you were bad. I didn't feel like I belonged at all. And I felt like I was searching for something, and I couldn't find it. I just couldn't grasp what was being said to me. And during all this church exploring, I started drinking alcohol at 11. I had my first drunk at 11, I guess. Is a better way of putting it. And that was it for me. I drank all the way up until I was, I think, 30. 5 days before my 30th birthday. So I had problems all throughout high school, legal, high, you know, problems with the school, problems with the parents, with the drinking. It's my family history. My dad's a recovering alcoholic. My brother's an alcoholic. My pretty much everybody on my mother's side is an alcoholic except for my mom. I was also, at the age of 16, diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but there is depression and some manic episodes. So highs and lows go back and forth. So along with just regular teenage hormonal stuff, there's this bipolar stuff, and that started very early with me. It started really at 9 is when that was triggered for me, really pretty severely at the age of 9. So I was taking medication for that and drinking on top of that, which is always a lovely idea. Let's see. So I thought that, and from what I was gathering from adults, that church would be this place where I could go and kind of escape from all this pain that I was feeling. And I was using the alcohol to kind of escape from that pain, and I just, that wasn't working. Eventually, in my early 20s, I moved to Fort Collins, Colorado. That's where I met Basil, my husband. And, you know, we were both kind of looking at different things. He was a recovering Catholic, and I actually met him at a liquor store. He worked at one, I worked at another, and I went to his so I could drink before I went to my job. So that's how I met him. He you know, he suggested, though, because we would talk about, you know, spirituality and different things, kind of different things that we had experienced. And, you know, he had suggested there's the, I finally looked up the name, Shambhala Mountain Center. I don't know if anybody's heard of that, but that's in, Red Feather Lakes, Colorado. And he also suggested that I go along, which was really unnerving to me because that, it seemed like someplace I wanted to share with him, but he's like, no, he had went, and he's like, go along, you really need to, there's just energy there. And that's unusual for him to say, because he's not really an energy type person, but he said he felt something when he went there. So I did, and I did the, you know, you walk in, and there are all these people, and I kind of ignored all the people that were hanging out, getting food, and doing their business, and walked along the path, and you walk along, and so pretty. And then you get up to this cabin, and you go in and you watch the video of how you go up to the stupa. And you watch how the stupa is made and the history of stupas. And I'm still not really quite sure what a stupa is, except it's big and it's pretty and lots of prayer flags. And I think in the center column there's supposed to be, there's supposed to be like pieces of Buddha's backbone in there, something kind of...
Buddha's relics are supposed to be in a stupa.
Yeah, yeah. So that was kind of neat. So I watched this video, and then I, like, go up there. I'm like, oh, okay, here we go. But I went inside, and it was really, really, just really cool. You know, I've been into a number of churches, and for me, I cry at the drop of a dime. But when I walk into church, I would start to feel something. Like, I wanted to... would start to be able to release the pain and want to cry and could kind of feel it in my stomach and my heart, but I wouldn't be able to because I would start listening to the words. But here, there was nobody there. You know, at this stupa, nobody was there telling me these words or saying anything. And so I was walked in and I sat down and I just started to cry, and it was a really cool experience. And, so I felt like I was able to release the pain, which was really cool. Yeah, I didn't do much with it afterwards. Just drank. We moved to Minneapolis, and that's where my drinking got really bad. You know, I already had Amory at this point, you know, so I'm mothering and drinking. And I finally hit my bottom. Thank goodness, you know, as horrible as it was, I hit my bottom. I started doing outpatient treatment. I found a really cool AA group. And I was also reading, in my early sobriety, Rational Recovery by Jack Trimpe. And it was a cool book just in itself. I mean, it's kind of an AA bashing, which I didn't really care for that so much, but I liked what he had to say. And it really helped me stay sober in my first couple weeks before I found my AA group. And then my dad had told me he had heard about this Buddhist recovery group led by Judith Regeer at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. And so I went and checked that out. And that was the coolest thing ever. I don't think I had ever meditated with... I don't think I'd ever really meditated, just maybe in my own way. But with a group of people, it was a guided meditation, and it was just the coolest thing ever to sit in this group with this group of people, and they're all in different stages of recovery and meditating. And it felt so good, and I was able to get a lot out just sitting there and just feeling everything. And and then the talk afterwards, you know, was just really cool. So that really, you know, I just, you know, that was my recovery. You know, it was just so good. I ended up, you know, I'm still doing the steps for AA. And step three is, because I don't necessarily have them memorized, but step three is, I was struggling with it, but it's made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him, or as we understand God. So turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I was having a hard time with that. I mean, people use the group as God. I mean, you use whatever you want as God, but I was just struggling because I wasn't sure how I understood God. I just couldn't. Anyhow, so at one of the meetings at the Buddhist group, there was a guy telling his story, and he started talking about step three, and I was like, all right, here we go, bring it on, I need help with this. And so he said that his step three, his God, is Zazen. That's what he uses as God. And to turn his life over to Zazen, to come sit on the mat. He said, sitting, breathing, feeling, letting go, and coming back. And just for me, it was like that moment of clarity. It just made sense that Zazen would be God. I don't know. I don't know. It was just that worked for me anyhow. So that was really cool. And I wanted to read this passage out of the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions by Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's on step three. So it says, practicing step three is like the opening of a door which to all appearances is still closed and locked. All we need is a key and the decision to swing the door open. There is only one key and it is called willingness. Once unlocked by willingness, the door opens almost of itself. And looking through it, we shall see a pathway besides which is an inscription. It reads, "This is the way to a faith that works." And for me, the faith was Zazen, to come sit on the mat and to just be here. And that worked for me. That works, and it still does. That's what works for me. So here we are, my family and I in Chicago. We moved to Chicago. I struggled to find an AA group. Found out that there's no Buddhist groups. The AA groups were seemed very Christian based. I tried a lot, and and that was fine, and that is fine. I love AA. I think it's just awesome. I was having a hard time with at least the ones that I went to. Anyhow, I found a quad A group, and that's Atheist Agnostic Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's so. And it turns out now, we're just now, it's on the AA website. You know, you can go on Chicagoland AA and there it is. And, but it's always kind of been separate, but now there's a movement to connect to them. They're really becoming connected now. So that's a really cool gig. And so that's what I do. But I wanted to still do Zazen, and well, at least I could learn more about Buddhism. I'm still interested. My dad was doing Buddhist stuff, and he was really excited about it. And he gave me this book, Idiot's Guide to Buddhism by Gary Gack. And so that was really cool just because it has the just all the technical stuff. And so it was really informative and easy for me to understand the reading. So I did that, and I was reading that. I found Ancient Dragon, and I've been here ever since. and this is part of my sobriety. I mean, I use this as part of my sobriety. I come here, and it helps keep me sober. So over the last year and a half, seems like it should be more than that. But at least a year and a half. I've been learning about the precepts just through the Dharma talks and just through reading. And then I learned about the number five, a disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate the mind or body of self or others. See, I have it written down there. It's easier to say from memory. Now, the way I understand that, not intoxicating the mind or body of self or others is to not get myself drunk or others drunk. I mean, that's just my way of thinking. That would be my black and white Through the different talks, though, and through reading, I've been reading the Being Upright by Reb Anderson. That helped broaden my view. He has a story that he told in here, and I guess I didn't realize that Reb Anderson had lived or grew up somehow in Minnesota, and he was talking about an autumn day, and how the leaves were all just crystal clear, all these different colors, everything was just spectacular, beautiful, and then all the rain came, and so it knocked some of the leaves down. It wasn't quiet, it was gray, and he was driving along, and he's like, boy, this is beautiful, but I wish the sun was out. That would help give it a little bit more, you know, so it's just like adding, like, just a little bit more. And that really helped add some clarity to my thinking of addiction. Wanting that little bit more. Boy, I wish I had a little bit more coffee. I wish I had a little bit more salt. I wish it was a little cooler. You know, just little things that can really lead to a downward spiral for me, for sure, and for anybody, I think. And so I thought that that was a cool story. It helped. Let's see. And I wanted to say that it just not even only the ingestion, eating, drinking, sniffing, snorting, anything like that, I started connecting addiction with the other precepts. So killing, stealing, sex, lying, talking of others, which is a huge one, because I think, you know, I'll do that. I do, you know, but I'm learning, and I'm being more aware of that. So it's really easy to get caught up in any of these things. And they're all intoxicating, and there's serious implications to everything. Let's see, there was another thing that Reb Anderson said that I wanted to read. Whenever the use of a substance or a state of being is based on craving, it becomes an intoxicant. So I guess I kind of already said that, but the based on craving, and I was like, oh, and that's, again, that's like, I crave fresh air, you know, I just went up to like northern Minnesota, and I'm, you know, and I know it's not, I'm exaggerating, but really, it's like that serious. It's like that sitting on our cushions, doing Zazen can be an addiction, you know, it can be. I really think that that's an important thing to remember. There was also one more thing. I shouldn't have closed the book, I guess, because it's... this is about the precept also. This precept is about liberating self and others from self-concern. It is precisely about not using anything to improve anybody and using everything to help everybody. This precept is about dropping all self-concern and appreciating all beings just as they are. Now, that reminds me a lot of the 12th step. I know I keep quoting, but the 12th step is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So it's reaching out to others and taking care of ourselves and taking care of others. And I think it's just such an important thing to do. I mean, if that, you know, just if everybody practiced that alone, I mean, really, and really mindfully practiced that, like how, what a difference, you know, things, it would just be so different. So recovery is Buddhism for me in so many ways, and I want others to know that. I want to share that with others. I want other people to feel better. I would like them to, you know. It's good to have other people that are out there that know what's going on and how it feels. So, and that's, you know, we're gonna be doing this recovery group here and a support group, and I think that that's just awesome, and I'm really excited about that. There was one thing I wanted to note in here that when he was writing about this precept, I didn't notice anything about that addiction being a disease, alcohol being it. So, you know, I want to remind people too that it is a disease and it's biological and physiological and psychological. I mean, it's whacked. It sucks, and just it really does. And just it really does. You know, if you think about that biological. So I think of Amory, and I think about my possible grandchildren. You know, I mean, it's there, and so that's kind of crazy. So I wanted to read one last thing. Joyfully sharing the study and practice of this precept with others can serve as a reminder of the almost inconceivable horror of violence and cruelty, the immeasurable suffering that arises from the use of intoxicants, which itself arises from the impulse to modify our present experience. In doing so, I hope that we can acknowledge and guard against our own self-righteousness. We must remember that all of us have this impulse very close at hand. All of us are capable of wishing to turn the sun up a little brighter. And that's really all I wanted to say this evening on addiction. There was one thing I kind of wanted to share along the lines of it being a disease. And this was something that I learned in outpatient treatment. And this was about the disease part of it, and that it's kind of there's a bell curve that you hit where it's hard to turn back, where you're going to have to get help. And if I could borrow your hand, this is the bell curve, okay? And people that have addiction in their family, okay? And people, this is the people that have the addiction that don't have addiction, this is the people that do. So when you're born, you're already born up here. Okay, you're already born up there. Your first drunk, you go up here, the other person only goes up this high. The second one, you're up here, the other person. So you reach that curve quicker than, you know, so anybody can have addiction, but it's gonna be quicker for the person without. And I don't know if that's true with all like more talked about addictions like sex or gambling, that kind of stuff. But I know that at least for chemicals and drugs and alcohol. But so I just wanted to share that because I thought that was neat. But I am very grateful for being here and grateful for you guys listening tonight and your support, because I think everybody knows pretty anxious about doing this. But so thank you.
Thank you, Dawn. Thank you for sharing your journey so straightforwardly, and I think it's helpful for all of us tonight. So I wanted to open it up if people have comments or questions or responses for Dawn.
I'm open for if you have any questions, for sure.
I just have one question about your dad.
Yeah.
How did it come? I mean, you hadn't said anything before about, I guess you've been to the Rocky Mountain Chambal Center, but your dad, you know, came to you and sort of gave you this book about Buddhism and suggested like Buddhist recovery groups and stuff like that. Was he, was this because he was aware of your, urging you to go into some kind of a program, but aware of your conflict with, or difficult history of Christianity, that kind of thing, or where did that come from?
Yeah, well, he knew. He was kind of like, I've never really done the technical AA stuff. I mean, I do, but I don't. I don't have a sponsor, so he was always the person I called. And so he knew anytime I struggled with stuff, you know, I'd call him. So he was kind of like, well, here's a different approach. You know, so I would ask all sorts of different people. But he also knew I was curious about the spirituality, because that's such an important part of recovery is spirituality. And so, and I was struggling with that. And so, yeah, that was another, you know, and he had just heard about Buddhism from a Catholic priest who had left the order, who had left the practice and has now gotten into Buddhism. So he passed that along to me. But yeah, so he was just looking for different ways himself. He's also in the field. That's what he does, is addictions group of work. So.
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much for the wonderful talk slash lead.
Thanks.
When you were reading about the third step, about willingness and you have to turn the key, it made me think of some people were here yesterday, but not everyone was. Tiger was talking about self-power versus other power in Zen and in other forms of Buddhism, including Jodo Shinshu Buddhism. And the idea, I'll just try to poorly encapsulate that we can't do all these things on our own. We can't even really do Zazen by ourselves. We can participate, but part of it is everything kind of coming and doing it with us. And people will talk about do you do Zazen or does Zazen do you? And I always like thinking about that. And so I love that you kind of saw Zazen as your higher power.
Yeah.
And the talk yesterday made me think about God. I heard someone once talk about God as a doorknob. That for their higher power, make it a doorknob.
Right.
And I just love that because I was like, God is a doorknob or whatever we want. It's like you have to participate with it, but there is, and then you can sort of open the door and you can throw yourself at the door all you want, but you need something, to participate with or to interact with. So I just really appreciated that in your talk.
Thank you. Well, and I was thinking about it because I knew I was going to be talking about it when we were talking about faith yesterday. Just that, pretty much what you just said, Nancy, and being active. Definitely you have to be taking the steps, I think. But.
I especially like the idea of turning it up a little brighter.
Yeah.
At least it's new. And it probably is what causes me to go through depression from time to time. But the sense of just wanting things to be different or having this image of the way you think things are supposed to be and trying to get them to be there.
Right.
So I think that's universal.
Yeah. It would only be better if. This would be a little bit better if. I wish.
And so many things, we use so many things to deal with, to avoid tension or sadness or fear or anger, just about anything. I mean, I can hide myself in a book or, you find yourself sometimes saying, well, I'm really tense, I think I'll sit down and do Zazen. I mean, what's the difference between that and having a beer?
Right.
So,
right.
I think, Maizumi Roshi had problems, was an alcoholic.
Yes.
And he always said that the way to look at the third step was that you're placing yourself in the hands of the Dharma.
Okay.
That following the Dharma will, not just for an addict perhaps, but for all of us who have repetitive sort of addictive patterns in our lives, that Dharma can make us well.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting can help us get well and healthy.
That's why I keep coming back.
Yeah.
I just want to respond a little bit to the difference between Zazen and a beer.
If we use it, I think you can use Zazen exactly like a beer. That's not the way we want to do it. We want to face things. Zazen should not be a way of turning away from things.
Exactly.
But it can be.
Exactly. And maybe for some people, beer can be used like Zazen, even. I think, and but what you brought up is that for some people there is this physiological thing. It's a real thing. I've seen it. I know, you know, people. I have a good friend who I started practicing with 35 years ago, who's an alcoholic who hasn't touched a drink in 35 years, and if he took a little sip, he'd be in trouble. So I understand. This is a really deep question, this whole question of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
One way to think about it is, what is it that takes us away from ourselves, or what is it that we use to run away from ourselves? So I think you've expressed it beautifully for your own journey. I sometimes feel there is such a thing as a positive addiction, that maybe my addiction to Zazen is better than other things I might be addicted to, partly because Zazen does bring you back to yourself, and I think that's part of what you were speaking to.
I think exercise too, like runners, and you know, I know, yeah, because there's that. I mean, there are
endorphins.
Yeah, I mean, there's better ones. I mean, you know, so for sure, I agree with that.
Good.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. Your presence is so lovely.
Thanks.
It's good, so I can't believe it. But I'll believe it.
Oh, man.
So I guess one of the things that I thought about in this whole question of Zazen, addiction or something, you know, but I was thinking that there's also this piece of the practice period, the one of the terms for it is within restraint. And, we are fast loose and out of control. You know, whether alcohol almost is kind of a nice addiction because it's so obvious and gets us into trouble so quickly. But it's like endless. You know, and then, you know, Douglas, you said something like, you know, there's so much potential for us to hear. You know, the beauty of life and the horror of it is so intense, and how to just hang out with that, relax with it, and just enjoy it, you know, it's like the most advanced human evolutionary thing, I'm convinced, maybe it's not a therapist, I think it is, but you know, there's so much stimulation we have to deal with all the time, if you're just a little off, you're just, you know, in the addiction realm. You know, whether it's because of the bipolar process or whether it's because of, you know, some kind of addiction to an idea about oneself, which is, you know, really nice insight that you always might have. But, you know, there's something like that kind of restraint helps us calm down. So maybe even if we're not actually maybe in some perfect Zazen state, sitting might be, you know, don't do anything.
Yeah.
Until you calm down enough to have a beer and enjoy it fully.
Yeah.
But you know, it's kind of an interesting thing because I think, we can make anything into an addiction. But we also, I think, you know, can make anything into something. We don't have to make it into anything beautiful.
Right. Well, and that's, I think, like I said, sitting in the room of people that were at different levels of recovery, you can sit there white knuckling. You know, you can, I mean, there are people that are fresh off the street. And so it's really an intense feeling. And it is, it's just sitting there, just sit. That's all you can do. That's all you can do. And especially when it's new. But that's also why in AA they say it's one day at a time. And one moment, it's moment to moment, and so does Buddhism. It's moment. It's, you know, you just, you know, you can't look to the future and know. You just have to sit. You know, just sit. And I so.
David.
Again, I just want to thank you as well for giving this talk and kind of telling your story. I mean, I've known you since you first came to the group, and maybe I can connect with us a little bit, but I really didn't know all of that. So it's very nice, and I appreciate it. And you know, they say kind of good is bad, and bad is good. You know, so like the good aspect, in a way, you know, song-wise, is you know, you sort of taking refuge here, and you know, you become a really kind of nice, solid presence here, and I really appreciate that, and it's been a nice thing for the group, and you now being work leader and being on the board on that, it's been really nice, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, David. It's very nice.
Yeah, I really appreciate your talk and just sort of your coming out. You know, I mean, I knew a little bit about you, but I think that's really courageous. And it's not. I mean, this is part of my past, and I've taken a different approach to it. But under your inspiration, I feel inspired to let people know that because I've never done that here. But one of the things that I use in my own life is something from the jewel near Samadhi, which is this line, you know, it's kind of twisting the thing a little bit. But there's a line, you know, it's like a massive fire turning away and touching, they're both wrong.
Right.
And, you know, and thinking about that line, I'm a little uncomfortable with, you know, the sort of looseness with which people apply and extend the concept of addiction, because it is useful to do that about certain things, and we can certainly, you know, a person without the disease, so to speak, you know, may feel a little tension and, you know, drink a beer, you know, and maybe that's a good thing to do, maybe it's a bad thing to do, you know, or it indicates, you know, a more sort of pervasive kind of thing about what it is to be alive, you know, the way that Hogeski was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is about certain people, you know, they drink a beer, they'll go up in flames. I mean, they go up in flames. And like the friend that Tygen was talking about. And that is a little different, you know, while it's useful to talk about, you know, to extend the, I think it's very, very useful and appropriate to use the concept of addiction as a way to get to the nature of craving, which is, you know, central to human existence and certainly central to the way Buddhism sort of represents and tries to understand human addiction or human condition. But I also think that in a way, it doesn't quite obscures the massiveness, if you will, of a problem like alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is like not a simple matter of like, you know, craving, you know, it's like craving at a deep down cellular level that's become so, you know, I'm sure it's true of, you know, other chemical addictions and, you know, possibly, you know, sort of sexual compulsions, those kinds of things. But I think it's really, you know, difficult for people who have not dealt with it to sort of understand, you know, how completely deep down that goes. In the same way it's difficult for people who've not experienced, you know, clinical depression to understand what that's about and kind of say, you know, well, you know, cheer up, you know, or in the same way people say, well, you should stop drinking, you know.
Right.
It's like, and so...
Just don't.
This is all my way of saying, I think it's both useful to look at it, I mean, things in both ways, but I also sort of completely want to, you know, honor, you know, the sort of massive accomplishment that you have undertaken, and you know, and also to express what some other people have said here, which is I really like having you around here. I think it's it's great.
Thank you.
You know, this you know, you know, I was thinking Arasaki was okay, but we just need to notch it up a little bit, you know, a little more sunshine. I think you're it, you know.
That's very super. I like that the not turning away.
Turning away and touching are both wrong.
Yeah, turning away and touching. Because if you turn away, you're going to forget.
Right.
You know?
You need to keep that.
But you can't touch. Holy crap. You know, I would be, you know, I can't. Mm-hmm. I don't even like walking by a bar, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can do it now, you know, further into sobriety. You know, I can deal with it. Basil drinks, alcohol, you know? I mean, there's certain things I ask him not to have in the house, but, you know, he doesn't get drunk and, you know, he's not unruly. But there's certainly no more, you know, keggers for Amory's birthdays or anything, you know, like, geez.
She's only six. Well,
her first two. So, but anyhow, I do appreciate you letting me share and letting me be a part of this, because all of you people mean so much to me and being here, so.
Well, thank you very much, Dawn. It's very sweet, and what a wonderful song that we have.